I fear thee, ancient mariner, I fear thy skinny hand, and thou art long and lank and brown, as is the ribbed sea sand. Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate it. If you're a newcomer, welcome. Please peruse our backlog of episodes. And to any returning listeners, thank you guys as always. And if everyone would please rate, like, download, sub, follow, etc., whatever your platform of choice asks you to do to support your creator of choice, please do that. Don't really have many follow-ups from last week, but I do want to thank everyone who downloaded. We had a lot of downloads last week, at least of the audio version. So, thank you all. I hope you're all returning. This week, we will be talking about some of the humans living on the islands of the Aegean Sea between 6 and 4,000 BC, BCE. Quite frankly, there's not too much to go on with the exception of, like, one or two very specific places. And they're all kind of, again, we're kind of seeing that Western Turkey situation, Western Anatolia, excuse me, where, you know, there's a lot of same going on, but there's not like any kind of large scale interconnected civilization, at least that we've found, or proto-civilization or material culture, whatever you want to call it, at least not that we found. And there's some reasons for this, and we'll get into that shortly. So this episode's probably going to have quite a lot of geography talk and etymology and a little bit of Greek mythology. So let's get on into it. First, I should go ahead and point out there's some debate about the exact sea level of the Aegean Islands at this point. Some think that they were at modern levels around 6,000 BC. Others say that they're not really what they are today until around 4,000 BC. Regardless of when this happened, the rising sea levels, and in some cases, final separation from the mainland, undoubtedly, you know, disrupted human habitation and life on the islands, and there may be sites on these islands that have been buried underwater. In fact, some myths that we will be discussing related to etymology may be long-preserved nuggets hinting at flooding in the area. We'll talk about that. Another situation may be that there's just not a lot of land on some of these islands that is useful for agriculture or herding, so, you know, they have to kind of keep it in use. So there may not be areas on this on these islands where they see, you know, deliberate layers of burial or, you know, reconstruction. So some of these sites may have been in continuous use since, you know, the period we're talking about, and thus you know, that hasn't really had a chance to accumulate large amounts of debris and things like that. So that may be another reason for some of the missing artifacts. But we know people are here. We know that they're traveling from there. We know that, you know, agriculture, herding of goats, sheep, some cattle, they're all coming through these Aegean Islands, and in some cases have already been on these islands for, you know, maybe 1,000 years, 500, so on and so forth. But we'll get into that now, or we'll get into that shortly. But first, I wanted to talk about oceanography, or I guess is it still geography? I'm not quite sure. But the Aegean Sea is a subdivision of the Mediterranean Sea, and it covers around 214,000 square kilometers, or 83,000 square miles. Today, it has two countries bordering it. This is the country of Greece, of course, and Turkey. I'll be able to post a photo of it on YouTube's episode, but if you're not familiar with Greek or Turkish geography, this may be a little hard to picture, but I'm going to do my best to kind of explain it. The western boundary of the Aegean Sea is the eastern seaboard of the Peloponnesian Peninsula, which is, the very south of Greece. The eastern boundary is the western coast of Anatolia and the western half of the island of Rhodes. The southern boundary is the northern shores of the island of Crete, and the northern boundary is the coasts of Greece's central and eastern Macedonian and Thrace regions. The Turkish province that this northern border touches is Edirne. Now, every bit of water to the southwest and east of those boundaries belongs to another part of the Mediterranean Sea. There is also another maritime border to its northeast. This is known as the Hellespont or the Dardanelles Strait. This is one of the dividing lines of Europe and Asia. Today, this strait is a stretch of water that is 61 kilometers, which is like 39 miles long, and at its narrowest point, it is 1.2 kilometers wide, which is like 3/4 of a mile, give or take. And then at its widest, it is 6 kilometers, which is like 3 3/4 of a mile. The city of Troy from the Trojan War / Iliad fame, or the city that those myths were based on, gained power and wealth from guarding the entrance to this strait. Now, this strait enters into the Sea of Marmara, which is the small water, body of water between the Black and the Aegean Seas. The strait between the Marmara and the Black Sea is known as the Bosphorus. Now, as for the etymology, I've covered the Black Sea and Bosphorus before, and I'm sure I'll talk more about their names in the future too, but they're not really the focus of this week's episode. The Sea of Marmara gets its name from the largest island, Marmara, which comes from the Greek marmaron, which means marble. The island was home to very productive marble quarries, and they may still be there. I didn't look that up, but that's where the name comes from. Originally, the island was called Proikonesos, or Prokonesos, which translates literally as before the island. I didn't think this name made much sense, but the ancient Greek name for the body of water was the Propontis, which was before the sea, or in front of the sea, or in this specific case, in front of the Black Sea. So maybe the name of the sea influenced the name of the island, which also could have originally been something like Proxkonesos, the island of the roe deer. Prox is the proto-ancient Greek for roe deer. Or maybe there's another etymology I missed. That's certainly possible too. If anyone has any suggestions, please let me know. Now back to the Hellespont or the Dardanelles. The modern name in Turkey, they refer to it as, and it's either the Kanakal or Kanakale Boğazi, which is literally the Strait of Kanakale. Now this is a modern city on the Asian side of the strait. Its name is a combination of Kanak, which is pottery, and Kale, meaning fort. During the Ottoman period, this area was home to a fairly sizable and fairly famous pottery industry, and it was also home to one of two fortresses guarding the strait, so hence the name. Today, the city has around 140 to 150,000 people. And the name Dardanelles is specifically tied to the fortresses. Both of those fortresses, one on the Asian side and one on the European side, were collectively called the Dardanelles. And that name was actually something that there were forts there prior to the Ottomans showing up. Of course, the Ottomans took over, and they, of course, kept those forts up to date and modernized. But their Greek name came from the ancient Greek city of Dardanus, or Dardanos, or Dardanon, depending if it's using the masculine, feminine, or neuter forms. And the area remains populated up to today, though I had a hard time finding its current population. The most recent figures I found just said 1900s and listed it as around 8,000 people. Since then, I think it's been combined administratively with like a town just to the south of Kanakali called Kapes, and that has around 35,000 people. And Kanakali is about 8 kilometers or 5.5 miles to the northeast of the site of the old Dardanus tumulus mound. And here's where we're going to go a little bit off topic, but also kind of on, and I'll explain that in a little bit. But according to Greek myth, Dardanus was named after the mythological hero Dardanus. His name probably was related to Dardapto, which was meant to slay or to burn, or possibly Dardapto, which is like devour or to eat. And he was one of two, some versions three, sons of Zeus and Electra. Now, this is not the famous Electra, the daughter of Agamemnon, who has a couple of plays about her, and who Carl Jung named the female version of the Oedipus complex after. No, this is Electra, and she is one of the seven Pleiades. And by the way, the name Electra just means amber, by the way. So even the gods will use basic names for their children, or at least their female children. But the Pleiades were the seven daughters of the Titan Atlas and an ocean nymph. Now, who that nymph was changes. It's not really important, but we'll maybe talk about her later. Eventually, Zeus turns these sisters into the stars of the constellation of the same name. Why he does this varies. It's usually to protect them from something, but just keep that in mind. Their name came from the root pleo, which meant to sail. And the constellation was very important to sailors of the Mediterranean, because when the constellation began to appear in the night sky, it meant that that was the start of the sailing season, or the safest period of the sailing season, I guess, was beginning. And sailing is very important to the myths around Dardanus. Now, some accounts claim that Dardanus traveled from a region of Greece known as Arcadia after a great flood. Now, this isn't necessarily the Great Flood. The Greeks' Great Flood myth involved a man named Deucalion, but some myths involving him don't mention a flood at all. And the Greek version of the Great Flood myth could have been, you know, adaptations of the flood myth of Mesopotamia, and they kind of made that flood seem more in line with the Mesopotamian flood, or they could have tried to line that up to kind of, you know, rationalize the timing on everything, you know, historically. But the Greeks had several stories of peoples living along mountainsides, surviving a number of floods. They don't just have necessarily one flood myth, though they do, again, tie the Great Flood myth with this individual known as Deucalion. And Deucalion's important because he was either the grandfather or the father of a man known as Helen. Now, this is obviously not Helen of Troy, but the man Helen is the ultimate ancestor of all the Hellenes, which is the Greek endonym for themselves. They do not consider themselves Greek. They are Hellene. Anyway, after the Dardanus flood, several groups of survivors remained on the various parts of the land that had been separated by the flood. However, due to the destruction caused by the waters, there was a lack of usable land to support all the people that remained comfortably. So, some decided to set sail in search of a new home. Dardanus led this expedition, leaving his son Demas behind to rule those remaining in Arcadia as a king. He then leads his expedition to the islands of Samothrace in the Aegean Sea, where his mother was from. Now, this is just one version of Dardanus's myth. Well, a couple of versions, but that's like one version of the starting. Others have him born on Samothrace since his mother lived there, and has him leave there on a hide raft due to various circumstances. Sometimes due to a flood, other times the land just wasn't enough for all the people that were living there. So, some versions have him starting in Arcadia. Some versions just have him on Samothrace because that's where he lived. That's where he was born. That's where his mother is from. And even in later versions, sometimes the Greeks and later the Romans will put him as far away as Sicily or Italy. As the Greek worldview expands, they begin to retcon some of their myths to kind of tie all these regions into their ancestral stories. But we'll get into more to that later. But all myths regarding Dardanus have him involved with Samothrace, and him eventually leaving Samothrace. But after he leaves, his younger brother Iasus, or Ision, or Etion, different versions of the same name, becomes king of Samothrace after his brother leaves. Dardanus then lands in Asia Minor at the city of Abydos, which is not the Egyptian Abydos, it just shares the same name. In fact, the modern city of Kanakale covers the site of Abydos, interestingly enough. But once he's at Abydos, Dardanus meets King Teucer, who welcomes Dardanus and his people, and being impressed with Dardanus himself and recognizing his strength and probably his divinity, he gives Dardanus his wife Batea in marriage, since his first wife had died by this point. At the suggestion of King Teucer, Dardanus leads his people to the south, where there are some mountains and marshes and springs where they can live. They weren't really city people, so they kind of preferred to be a little bit more rugged. And Dardanus helps his father-in-law with, defending his kingdom from various neighbors, going to war, that kind of thing. And eventually, he would die and be succeeded by his sons as king of the Dardanians, who are the people that he brought with him, by his wife, Batea. First by his son, Elus. However, Elus died young, and he was succeeded by his brother, Erichthonius, who was a very successful king. So successful, his son, Tros, expanded south and founded the Kingdom of Troy, where his son, named after his great uncle, Ilus II, founded the city of Ilius or Ilion, which we know as the city of Troy. That's why the Iliad's called the Iliad. It's about the city of Ilius, but the kingdom was Troy. The city, the capital of Troy, was Ilius or Ilion, which would ultimately guard the Dardanelles Strait, interestingly enough. Now, I know that a lot of you are thinking, well, okay, that's cool. Why are you talking about it? And I know it's a lot to take in, and it doesn't really have anything relating to the people of the Aegean Islands and sea between 6 and 4,000 BC. And you're correct, certainly. But I thought it would be helpful to illustrate life along the Aegean coast and some of the problems that they definitely had to deal with. And some of these problems are there from the beginning, and they're there even before the Greeks show up and begin mythologizing and historicizing everything. Dangerous travel conditions, flooding or unpredictable tides, having to be mindful of the seasons for travel, the lack of useful land. We also see the outcomes of these issues, having to leave your home to find a new one, being separated from family and loved ones, having to depend on strangers in these new lands that you travel to for survival. So while these myths probably don't cover, at least, you know, not directly, again, some of these stories about floods may be very old and they're just brought forward, you know, every couple hundred years to have been, oh, this was during my grandfather's time, what was actually probably your great-great-great-grandfather's time. That sort of thing. But I do think they are kind of a useful illustration of some of the issues that some people are having to deal with. You know, again, they dress it up with talk of royalty and kings, but these people are, at this point, probably little more than, you know, chiefs or mayors in some cases, whatever you want to call it. But it also shows another thing that I haven't really touched on. I've mentioned it before, but it's something I kind of don't think about, but I think we should, and that is kind of back migration. The way we've kind of been covering stuff, it's like these people are all moving in one direction. Well, there's plenty of cases where people are moving back, and they're taking what they've learned from where they went and bringing it back in, or at least resources they found where they went and bringing it back. So, and we see this in Greek history. It's not just people living in what is now the modern country of Greece. They're living on the coast of Western Anatolia, and they are constantly traveling back and forth, and founding cities in these various places, and just, or are not necessarily founding new cities, but, sometimes a city needs people, and they'll contact a neighboring city like, hey, we need some people to help us, you know, stay alive. Would you be willing to send some settlers? And this happens in Greece proper and on the Western Anatolia coast. So there's a lot of back and forth. And, you know, there's a lot of interrelations with this. And sometimes people in the mother country like, hey, we need some soldiers, or we need people skilled in a specific trade. Would you be willing to send us some specialists or something like that? And we'd be glad to incentivize them and to incentivize your city, you know. So it's a back and forth. It's not all in one direction. It's not people just leaving Asia for Europe. There are people in what is now Europe going back to Asia. So keep that, because, you know, sometimes people fall into that trap, and I'm certainly guilty of it. I probably should have been pointing that out a little bit more prior to this, but, so just make of that what you will. Also, I figured this is a good point to talk about and introduce a people known to us as the Pelasgians. Now, I'll talk more about them in later episodes and in much more detail, but just know that this is a term, and it's fluid in our Greek sources, but these were the people living in Greece before the Greeks arrived, or at the very least, before their Hellenic identity emerged. They knew that they were not the first people living in the land that they inhabited. But, of course, they did acknowledge that some of their ancestors were what they would consider Pelasgians. Dardanus was said to leave a lead a group of Pelasgians. In fact, Arcadia, in some Greek sources, they considered Arcadia the home of the Pelasgians. This is the mountains kind of to the north of Laconia, where Sparta was, or kind of to the north west of Argos, or the Argolid, or to the west of Corinth and Athens. This is a very rugged, mountainous, forested country. And that was, by many Greeks, considered to be the home of the Pelasgians. They were the first inhabitants there. Of course, they moved out from there, and they occupied other places, and they had some conflicts with the Greeks. They fought on the sides of the Trojans, at least according to Homer. Though I believe some Pelasgians also fought for the Greeks, but the majority of the Pelasgians fought for the Trojans in the Trojan War. I can phrase that better. I should say that the majority of the Pelasgian heroes who fought in the Trojan War fought on the side of Troy. There were plenty of, you know, non-fighters on among the Greeks and the Trojans and the Pelasgians. Now, for the other Greek name, the Hellespont, this means the scene of Helle. Helle was the daughter of a king, Athamantus. Athamas is the name of the king. He was a king in, I forget which part of Greece. But sometimes Helle is just called Athamantus, which means daughter of Athamas. But she and her brother, Phrixus, they were the children of King Athamas of Boeotia, I think is what it was. I think it was Boeotia. And a sea nymph. Now, Athamas's wife, the stepmother of the children, she did not like them, and she set them up to be sacrificed. She paid off an oracle, she paid off the delegate to an oracle, saying that the oracle told them that the king had to sacrifice his children to resolve some issue. I forget exactly what it was. They are rescued by a golden ram, and while the ram is flying them over the sea where they've, you know, where they were tried to be drowned, Helle falls off the ram's back into the Hellespont Strait, and depending on the version of the story, in some cases she drowns, in other cases she's rescued by Poseidon, and he turns her into a nymph like her mother, whereas Phrixus goes on and rides the ram all the way to, I think it's somewhere in the Caucasus. I forget exactly where. I think it's Colchis. And he gives the golden fleece to the king there, who treats him very kindly. And that's where Jason and the Argonauts have to go eventually to retrieve the golden fleece many years later. So, Hellespont comes from Helle, who is said to have, in some cases, again, drowned in that sea. Which, interestingly enough, that kind of relates to the etymology, in some ways, of the Aegean Sea, which we're going to turn back to right now. The name Aegean comes to us from Aegeus, depending on the Latin pronunciation. And this refers to a mythological Greek king, not surprising, named Aegeus, and he is the father of Theseus. Theseus is the one that slays the Minotaur, and when he's returning from Crete, he is supposed to raise sails of a specific color, showing his father that he's still alive. However, depending on the version of the myth, he either forgets, in some slanderous versions of the myth, he deliberately doesn't raise the sails, and his father, in sadness and despair, throws himself into the sea, and when his Theseus returns home, he has to mourn and bury his father, and then he becomes king of Athens. The Greek version of that would be Agial Pelagos, although they would also just refer to it as the sea, or the Sea of the Hellens, or the Hellenic Sea. All of these would work. Sometimes they'd call it the Sea of Many Islands. I believe that's the Turkish name, where the I believe they call it is Ege Denizi, which is the Turkish version of the Greek term Adalar. Those are both Turkish versions of the name. It's just the Sea of Islands is another term. That's like the Turkish term. Sometimes they don't always use that, but you'll also see a lot of Slavic languages, specifically the South Slavic languages. They all refer to it as some version of the White Sea. Bylo More, Belo More, if it's, I believe it's Serbian. It's Macedonian that's Belo More, and Bulgarian it's Bialo More. Also the term archipelago comes from that term. And we actually got archipelago from the Venetians, who at one period of time owned a lot of the Greek islands there, and they kind of took the popular Greek name for the area, and they referred to it as archipelago. Now, for us, archipelago just means like a chain of islands. That's how it's used in English. But it derives from the Greek, specifically referring to the Aegean Sea. So those are all various ways that the sea has been referred to. Now, to talk about the islands of the Aegean Sea. Now, the number of islands is not agreed on, because, again, people vary on their definition of what an island is. The range on this is pretty big. Some people say there's around 1,200. Others will say there's around 6,000. And most are Greek, though there are around 500 or so islands on the Aegean side of Turkey. Most of those, though, are very small, and very few are actually populated, at least on the Turkish side. For the Greeks, they have, again, the number varies, but some places say it's as many as 230, or give, you know, plus or minus a couple, are inhabited. Some have a fairly large population, and some have like just a couple of hundred people, and some even have less than 200. So just keep that in mind. And they are generally broken up into seven different groups of islands. These are the northeastern Aegean islands. These are the ones kind of to the south of Thrace, which sometimes is divided and called the Thracian Sea. Samothrace lies in that area. Then you have the eastern Aegean islands. These are the ones very close to mainland Greece. The largest of these is Euboea, which is right next to Attica, which is where Athens is located. Then you have the Sporades. Sometimes these are referred to as the northern Sporades. I'll explain why they're called the northern Sporades shortly. Then you have the Cyclades. These are kind of the ones kind of to the south east of Euboea, north of Crete. These would include Naxos, Santorini, Melos, Syros, which I believe is the most populated. Naxos is the largest, Syros is the most populated of those. Then you have the Saronic Islands, which these are the islands kind of to the south of the Isthmus of Corinth, which connects the Peloponnese with the rest of Greece. Then you have the Dodecanese, which are the islands around Rhodes and towards the west of those. Those are also sometimes called the southern Sporades, but that's very rarely used. And then, of course, you just have Crete and a couple of islands around them. And Crete, of course, is the largest island in the Aegean Sea, and also the most populated. And it's Crete that we're mostly going to focus on this for this episode, for this season, for the Aegean Islands. Now, that does not mean it is the only populated island. The Cyclades are definitely populated, so are the others probably during this season. But Crete's the one that you really find a lot of evidence prior to 6000 BC. And we talked about them last season, but around 7000 BC, you know, you begin to see permanent settlements prop up. The first one had around 50 people, give or take, living in Wadlandab huts. They had animals, and they grew crops that came through the Cyclades. And we know that because we find evidence of them on the Cyclades prior to that, and they don't show up in Greece until after they show up on Crete. In fact, the settlement I'm referring to is at Knossos, which is going to be kind of the center of what's known as the Minoan civilization. Now, the Minoan civilization emerges next season, but about 900 years after this season that we're going to be referring to. So this island very quickly becomes very populated, and it's going to be the start of what you might consider an urban civilization in Europe. But we'll talk more about that shortly. But for right now, we're going to start to cover the 6 to 5,000 BC, BCE period. And the village that started with around 50 people now has between 200 and 600 people, give or take. In fact, these people are living on what will become the big palace complex in Knossos eventually. But most of their homes are one or two room square houses made of mud brick and set on foundations of stone. They lined their interior walls with mud plaster. Their roofs were all flat with branches covered with mud. They dug hearths in the central location of the home. And these were dug down, and then they would make the hearth kind of in the center in kind of a little pit. Now, there was one unusual thing about this village. It did have one large house, and it had 8 rooms, and it covered about 50 square meters, which is about 540 square feet. And this is not just used for storage, because there were kind of sleeping, you'd call them like nooks or, maybe a cubicle, for lack of a better term. So this isn't something that's just used for storage, but this was a very large home compared to the other sites. All the homes had right angles. The doors were all central to one of the walls. So they had separate doorways and entrances into these houses. They were not coming in through the roofs like you see at some of the places in Anatolia we've discussed. Anyway, over the next 1,000 years, the number of houses grow, and the population is assumed to have reached right around 1,000 people at the high water mark. And these are all, well, they appear to be family homes. This is not like a communal area. It appears to have, contained a nuclear family. The construction was, they were all constructed the same way, though. They had, in some cases, windows and doors, and they all had a raised hearth in the center. So they began to build up the hearth instead of having them dug into the floor. You also see wood used more. Again, they did have doors and in some cases windows that they would make out of, they would kind of timber them. They would cut the holes in the things and cover them with wood. You also see a construction of another large home. And this one was about 100 square meters, which is about 1,100 square feet. And it was divided into 5 rooms with a meter of thick walls. And there's some suggestion that there may have had a second story there as well, though that is debated and it is hard to tell for sure. Now, there are other settlements on Crete, not far from Knossos, that continue to use the older the smaller houses. But Knossos itself just continues to grow in size. And there's an overlap in some of those areas adopting the newer housing versus the older housing. And this continues right up until 3000 BC, which is kind of like 100 years or so after the start of quote-unquote Minoan civilization. So this isn't something that's being phased out all at once. This is something that is slowly changing over time. Now, their pottery is very simple, but it's very well made. Most of it's simple brown pottery, though some do kind of have these etched in white lines in their pottery. And they have a wide variety of different shapes and sizes. They have some bowls that kind of have these pitchfork shaped edges. They have found ladles. And, of course, your standard pottery, which you would probably think of as cookware, with, covers and things like that. They are, of course, growing crops. I think emmer is a big crop that they're growing. They have some cattle, on the island of Crete, especially. They have more than that than anywhere else because they actually have the room for a large number of cattle, but they have plenty of sheep and goats as well. They're also fishing. They are using these small boats to kind of row out and spearfish things like tuna and other larger sea life as well. They, of course, have access to shells and things like that that they're probably using for trade. They may have had some obsidian. I've been trying to find specific sources about obsidian on Crete. I couldn't find too much directly, but we know that the island of Milos or Melos in Cyclades, which is not far north of Crete in the grand scheme of things, but Melos is known for its obsidian mines, and Melos is probably a large source of obsidian for the Aegean world. And it's probably one of the bigger places in the Cyclades in terms of trade and things like that. But that's kind of what I have for the Aegean islands for this period. Again, they're going to see a rapid growth, especially on Crete. And Crete's, again, the center of urban civilization. And as we'll talk about, they have very long reach when it comes to trade. They'll show up in Egyptian sources very early on in the written record. But that is all for future episodes. So, if you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can also contact me via direct message on X/Twitter. You can also comment on the YouTube videos. I will respond there, though not always immediately. Sorry for that phone notification. I thought I had that muted before I started, but kind of a busy day. Anyway, thank you all for joining me. I hope you have enjoyed. I hope to hear from you all, and I hope you will continue to download and all that other good stuff. And if you see me on YouTube, feel free to drop a subscribe there, and you'll get notifications when I go live. I do stream during the week, sometimes on the weekend as well. And I play history games, military games, that kind of thing. And occasionally other stuff. Because it's October, I've been playing a lot of horror. But October's almost over, so we'll be doing a little bit more normal fare, a lot more coming up. But you're welcome to drop in into the chat, say hey there. You can't post links there, so if you want to send me any articles or anything like that, please let me know via email or on Twitter, and I can follow up on those links from those sources. So, again, appreciate you all. I hope we'll see you all next time, and until then, have a good rest of your day or week from whenever you're listening to this, and I will see you all next time. Peace.